We can start with you, Jack. Okay, I'm not going to start with you. When did you, Tim, or when did anybody, anybody on this panel, can you tell me when you started seeing a difference, less community involvement? What did you notice? Give me an example of a time where you just kind of went, oh, things have changed.
Well, the thing that comes first to my mind is just making a change to my current parish, which is serves primarily the college students of Florida State, who are great, and I love them. But there's definitely I was there 16 years ago as a student, and I'm not a millennial. Let's just get that out there, right? Everything good you said about Generation X, yeah, that's me. Okay, I'm somewhere like on the cusp there. You too, right?
Yeah. Both there. I'm in the middle.
Yeah? Okay, nice. Good. Yeah.
Here we go.
But anyway, these, you know, I show up and I have a hard time getting altar servers. And I have a hard time getting lectors and people to volunteer to do stuff at Mass. And I thought, okay, well, maybe just no one's asked them. So I would ask them, which is amazing. I mean, people normally, the priest says, hey, could you please do this or volunteer? You think a couple people might come up. Nobody. I get up to, hey, we really need some help here, you know. So I started actually literally walking out before Mass. And I'll just point at people and say, come here. And they're like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm like, I don't care. Throw an alibi and let's go. And so now I've solved the problem in this way, but it was quite striking to me how they were all content to show up and not volunteer and not participate, just thinking that this was sort of like going to be provided for them. I don't know if that's it just seemed very different than like what I've experienced before. And when I was in college even, I felt like there was an abundance of people volunteering to participate in our services, whereas now it's almost pulling teeth sometimes, with that particular generation at least. Not bad for a quick answer.
I'm the host. I'll go last.
You're always trying to play something.
Okay, then even though I'm the moderator, I'll give you an example to get this rolling. And this actually was an example that my dad pointed out as we were trying to figure out how to go about sharing this topic with you. And he said, I have an example. He just came back from Phoenix, where he was visiting my brother for Thanksgiving, and lots of traffic on the highway, four lanes of traffic, moving very slowly, except for the HOV lane. It's two passengers are required to ride in the HOV lane. There you go. There's an example. All those other folks were in their own cars.
Mm-hmm. And there are some people who go in the HOV lane and put a fake person on the other side so that they get away with going faster and it looks like there's two people.
I would say one other, perhaps, observation. I mean, I didn't live long enough to maybe experience this, but I've lived long enough to see lots of houses with front porches and no one's sitting on them, mm-hmm. Right?
I would say that I've seen it in a little different way. When I was growing up mostly in Allentown, Pennsylvania, West Virginia for a little while, but in Allentown, you know, we all played ball. We all just, you know, the neighborhood kids all went out, and we went to the one kid's yard. He had a basketball net, you know, and we would pick up a ball, or in football season we'd play football. Or, you know, we just would all get together and play. My kids... growing up in the, you know, mid to late 80s and early 90s, in also in Pennsylvania, go outside and get together with the kids. And I have pictures of all the neighborhood kids sitting on our fence, like a wooden fence that we had, you know, like a log wooden fence. And it was, you know, really like neat to see the kids all together. And it struck us when we moved to Tallahassee, and we noticed this not in the beginning, but already, you know, 14, 15 years ago in our neighborhood, which... the neighborhood looks just like the neighborhood we lived in Allentown, or the neighborhood we lived in Ambler, Pennsylvania, outside of Philly. But nobody was outside playing with each other. Very rare to see the kids out in the street, you know, doing stickball or tag or whatever. It's like everybody is off in their own world. And I think a lot of that is, we forbid our children to play with Atari or whatever the computer games were when they were growing up. My wife was very strict, you have to go out and play. Okay, but now everybody everybody is into their own little computer game and whatever, and I think we've seen what we're seeing today in the an atomism or atomization of society, into these, and everybody's in their own little world, is the result of now basically a generation of not going and playing with your neighbor kids.
I can relate to being kicked out in the backyard in the summer. And no, you don't need to come inside to drink. That's what the water hose is for. Yeah. You know, so yeah, I think those days have passed. But yeah, that was us. You had to get out there and play, and there was no be inside or do your thing. And I think the other difference too is that we didn't have, at least how I was growing up, didn't have even the opportunities. It didn't seem like to, you know, be in every little customized sports league activity, whatever. So if you were going to play, it was going to be with the neighborhood kids, or else you weren't going to play.
Right.
It wasn't mom going to drive you across town so that you could be to your, you know, whatever craft class and then get to your sports team and then whatever. So,
yeah, when we moved from West Virginia to Allentown, like 3 or 4 days after we moved into our house, I was out and I was just kind of walking the alleyway between the houses, and I heard kids playing in a backyard, and I poked, you know, there was a bushes surrounding the yard, so I went to the edge of the bush and I looked in, and there were three boys playing with one boy's father. They were playing touch football, and the father saw me at the edge and he said, "Oh, come on in, then I don't have to, you know, you can be the fourth, you know, do two on two." Two of those boys are twins, born on the exact same day that I am. They're still my close friends to this very day. Okay, we just started playing, and that's how, and that doesn't happen. That just doesn't happen.
Another thing that has been noted is that there are fewer public spaces. The public spaces that we do have are really businesses. So the local Starbucks, for example, you can go there and be with other people, but it costs you $5 for a cup of coffee. So I was wondering, are there public spaces that you remember? I know we've already talked about the front yards. Are there public spaces that you remember growing up or that you've heard about if you're too young to remember that we used to enjoy and that we just don't have anymore?
Well, yes. So I was born in Peoria, Illinois, home of Richard Pryor. And in Peoria, at my grandparents' house, there was a huge field in the block over where all the kids would go. And my grandfather was Josh Mitchell. My grandfather was that guy. When you got up in the morning, you cleaned your body, you ate breakfast, you went outside. Because I was a boy, I had to go to the bathroom, you found a tree. You got thirsty, you found a water hose, but you ought to be outside having a good time. And the signal in my neighborhood was simple from my mom is, make sure you're back in the house when the street lights come on.
Yeah.
Actually, if those lights come on and you're outside, you've actually missed curfew. And then when we moved to Los Angeles, you know, there was two things. It was a local elementary school I ended up going to. But also in my neighborhood, we played football right there in the middle of the street. We called it sideline pop, which is if you're on the sideline with the ball, somebody's going to hit you. But it was the fun. You mentioned, going back to the first question, for me, I think it really became when I got to college. You know, I grew up in a very tight-knit family where we did a lot of stuff together. When I got to college, you started seeing that you started being trained where, you know, you get a job, you get a degree, get a job, became survival of the fittest. You became your own mindset, your own way of doing things in that regard. And so, like, my son now, who's 11, who's playing flag football for the YMCA, when they go out there and play, you watch it. Because actually what you see now is the kids are out there having fun, but the parents are actually occupied with their devices the entire time. For example, at his practice Tuesday, he was out there practicing, and I was in my truck on the laptop. And so I'm just as guilty, but you do see that. And so it's almost become an inconvenience when kids want to go outside. You have to almost bribe the parents to take you out because we find so many other things. Growing up in Illinois, the best time to go outside was when it was snowing. You wanted to play football in the snow. You wanted to get hit in the snow. You wanted to be extra. Now, as you mentioned, it's the game systems. And most of our young men have them at this church. Most of them don't even know eye-to-eye contact when they talk because they're so used to being in their gadgets to where they talk to you as if they're texting you. Everything is in acronyms because that's the world. Is individualized in that regard. And so until you get back, like our church here, I mean, our kids go outside and run around on that small piece of grass right there. That's what they run around every Sunday. And they'll play 10 on 10, that small grass, because they want to be outside. Whereas with us adults, we want to be where the air conditioning is.
Well, if the community is an ecosystem, and you've touched on some of these things, what is it that's polluted our system? Clearly, we've identified technology, which can be helpful in connecting and maybe harmful. What are the other contributing factors? I told you a little bit about the generational change and how that's contributed. What other things are going on? Why is this happening?
Even you mentioned technology, but even and you mentioned front porches earlier. That's one of those where air conditioning is the reason front porches went away. Because before my time, but if you wanted to cool off, you sat in the shade on the front porch, and that's when every house had front porches. That's when you would have community in the neighborhood because the parents are going to sit up there, the kids are going to play, parents or grandparents are watching. Once you had air conditioning, you can now go inside to cool off. Automatic garage doors. I mean, in my neighborhood, I can stand out front. I won't even know who the occupant in the car is because the garage door is going to go up, the car is going to pull in, the garage door is going to go down before they even leave the car. So just so many of those little touch points that you would have in a neighborhood or community. We all appreciate the benefits of, I'm not complaining about garage door openers or air conditioners or phones or anything else, but it's just a reminder that it allows us to drift from those personal, like Derek was saying, that eye contact, those personal connections. As much as we appreciate that benefit, it often comes with an unseen cost that we don't realize till later what it's cost us.
I remember a couple quick stories. When I was at Camp Lejeune 10, 12 years ago, we had a lightning storm come through, and it knocked out the power for several hours. And you could hear collective F-bombs going off when this power went off. And everybody was angry and upset because they were all inside. And this is before, you know, the smartphones and everything, but they were still on their computers or watching TV. And what happened that evening was wonderful. People got their nightsticks out, and we went outside, and we set them up. We'd, like, hang them on the railings, and we had moved our furniture outdoors on the balconies, and everybody hung out, and coolers of beer and everything appeared, and it was like a big party outside, you know, and everybody was having a great time, and then the lights came back on, and guess what? Everybody went back indoors and started watching TV. The same thing in the seminary. We had, when we got Wi-Fi at the seminary, it changed the whole lifestyle. We used to hang out in the halls. We used to walk around. People would stand outside. We'd talk. We got to know each other. We were always hanging out with each other. Once the Wi-Fi got put into the campus, suddenly people were just in their rooms all the time. And now you can watch shows and everything and get TV through your computer. So there was really no reason to go out. I just think in terms of our role as ministers, really, because I think this all contributes to this lack of community when you're not interacting with others. I mean, you think about what cyberspace is. And I think technology is a big factor in all this. And is Neil Postman, I don't know if anyone's ever heard of Neil Postman. He wrote several books on technology and television and its influence on society and politics and media, culture, religion even. He would say that technology gives us something. It's like a Faustian bargain. It gives you something and takes something away. And we're always very eager to get the new thing, and we're excited about it and wait in line for it. But we never actually stop and reflect and think, like, what is this going to cost me? What is this? How is this going to change how I relate to others in my society and so on? So technology brings both a good and a bad. I think that we have something to offer that's better than technology, right? I mean, I think people would rather have a conversation. So it starts with me, right? So just apropos, and I don't even know, I'm not even thinking about it. I downloaded an app this week called Checky. Anyone ever heard of Checky? It's a real serious name. It tells me at the end of the day, I've only had it for a few days, it tells me how many times I've turned my phone on, looked at my phone. Every time I check it, yeah. I'm pretty proud that I was under 50 yesterday. That's pretty good, I think. Because apparently the average is like well over 100, right? And some of that was stuff I had to do. It wasn't like I was just, oh, let's look at the news again for the 50th time. So these are the kind of things I'm trying it out because I want to talk about it at my services to encourage people. Because I think we do, walk around FSU, everybody's, you talk about public spaces, when that Pokemon Go app thing came out, everybody at Lake Ella, everybody at Cascades, they're walking around staring at their phones. So you know, I think we have to talk about it and be intentional and reflect on it if we're going to do something about it.
Anybody else want to comment on that one? So we're more isolated than ever. We're not talking to one another. We're on our phones all the time. Our heads are down even when we're walking around in public spaces. So what's the problem with that? I can tell you one thing is I think it's Younger, the writer who was formerly a Marine. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about? Anyway, he's come out with a recent book, but a lot of the studies about post-traumatic stress disorder among our military coming back, they have seen that what contributes to it is they come back to isolation. They've been a part of a team, they've had a purpose, they've had friendships, they've had conversations, they've been a unit, and now, so think of the Legos, they've been a unit, and now they have been set aside. And so there's an example, an extreme example perhaps, but what happens when we're disconnected? What other things are happening that are not good for us based on atomization?
Well, when we're not connecting, we're not when we're not connecting to each other, we are becoming desensitized to each other's needs, to each other's emotions, to each other's we're closing. I think that you're hitting upon something that has caused a lot of the problem that we see in the aftermath of the recent election, and that is people's inability to actually tolerate each other and talk to each other. We're so divided that we're not connecting across the line at all, and I think we've lost that. We're losing that ability to have that empathy to say, you know what, that person may feel differently for me, but why is that? Whereas if you're only looking at your Facebook page with the feeds that your Facebook page is giving you, because they know exactly what you like to look at, and they feed you exactly the things that they think you want to see, so you get further and further isolated from everybody else. Television was criticized because it sort of dumbed down, took drama and it dumbed it down, and so forth. But in the end, television was a community builder because it created talk around the water cooler. Okay, but our Facebook feeds, in a way, it's supposed to be a community builder, but it is an atomizer. Okay, now I will tell you that I try very hard to fool Facebook, and not to just read liberal things. I will often try and get on and read conservative things to see what else is happening and what other people are thinking, so that I don't just get fed the same stuff time and time again. I really want to know what the breadth of thought is that's out there, and then I can understand better what's going on.
Well, television, we used to watch it together. I remember playing outside with all our friends, and then it'd be like, Disney's starting, it's Wonderful World of Disney's coming on, and then the whole family would sit together, right? And then you would talk about it the next day, because there was only three channels, and all the kids you knew were watching the same show, versus having a different show, a different channel in their own rooms. But go ahead, what were you going to say?
Bonanza. Well, Bonanza on Sunday
Bonanza.
Night. Yeah, who remembers Bonanza, huh?
I want to, I'm the controversial one, I guess. I think another factor, let me just be direct. I mean, in my context, one of the safe havens in the Black community was always church. And so that was family, that was community, that was safe haven, things of that nature. And even today, it's still a safe haven. It's still protected. Dr. Martin Luther King said the most segregated hour of the day is 11 a.m. on Sundays. Because, there's a community and their understanding when you come together in that regard. And I will say that to you because I grew up in predominantly Black communities. And so my exposure to non-Blacks was usually going to be at school or when I got in the workforce. Now, I say that because for me, I want to correct my earlier answer. I think my atomization came when I ventured outside of the predominantly Black community and actually bought a house. And here is why. Because in that purchase, I've been living in my same house for almost 14 years. I know four neighbors on this block. And it's the four that are the closest to me. I bought the house from the original builder and owner, and her next door neighbor built his house in 77. Mine was built in 79. So Mr. Gibson is my next door neighbor. I know him well. He looks like me as well, but I know him well. Now, having said that, my context that I grew up in would never get outside of the neighborhood. And so the kids grew up together. They played around together. The next generation grows up together, so on and so forth. When I ventured outside of what I was used to, here's what I realized. Although I wanted a better life for my kids, my safety is within my four walls, not within my neighborhood. And so people come through the block. I may or may not wave at them, but I'm also, I don't feel convicted when I don't converse with my neighbors. Because the fact of the matter is I made this move for my kids not to become friends with anybody else. And so that, and I bring that up because even with church is there really isn't a major conviction when I get in my car, anyone's getting in our car and we go to a church that is predominantly looking like us. Because the fact of the matter is truthfully, I don't want to be inconvenienced. Most of us don't want to be inconvenienced. Hurricane Hermine blew our church away. And here is why, because we did something that we were forced to do. Our power was out for 7 days. And so one of my members of the church had a great idea. How about we bring all the food from our houses that's going to spoil? The men of our church brought in grills. We begin to cook all of our stuff, and we begin to service this community. Around the corner is a senior disabled community. We begin to service them. People could come by knowing we didn't know them and get a free meal. And people would say to me, I didn't know you were here. They were right up and down the street all the time. I didn't know you were here. They were surprised we weren't charging for anything. We didn't know what time we were having church on Sundays. Their church wasn't doing these type of things. And in that conversation, I began to realize that people are okay in certain things. Now that the hurricane is over, guess what's happened? We've gone back to our normal way of doing business because we're back to a place of comfort and convenience in that regard. You know, in my neighborhood, I have family over for Thanksgiving. I would tell them, hey, now listen, you can't park there. My neighbor's going to get upset. Don't be too loud. She's going to get mad. You know their dislikes. But when we first moved into our neighborhood, a neighbor across the street from my house came over, knocked on the door, and to my amazement, she presents me with a pound cake. I never go to my neighbor's house when they first move in. But it's also foreign to me because where I grew up, if I ran out of sugar, my next door neighbor would give me sugar. And it's what I was used to, but it also looked like me. And so there is a underlying feeling inside of most where if you don't look like me, so I really don't trust you enough to even want to sit on my porch and talk to you. If we can be honest about it. And it's the fact of the matter is I'm comfortable in my house. We just did renovations. We have a front porch. I have nice designs out there, nice chairs out there. I've never sat in those chairs because it's for the look. It's not for the conversation. When I wave at my neighbors, when they come by too fast or music is too loud. And I bring that up because the reality of it all is the atomization is easy because it's all about being inconvenienced. Anything that we do to be able to make change, I got to be willing to step outside of my comfort zone to branch out, to reach out, to be exposed. Jack and I have become friends. You know, we have different religious standings. We become friends because we both have come outside of our context to get to know each other. I'm not trying to sway. He's not trying to sway. We're trying to befriend. Tim and I recently had lunch. We had great conversation about various things. Here's the fact of the matter. None of that's possible, ladies and gentlemen, until we acknowledge there is an issue and we make a personal commitment to be a part of that change agent. And that's the truth of the matter. In my neighborhood, it's a great neighborhood. But I've been there 13 years. I know four people. Yeah. And I'm okay, honestly, with knowing those four people. And nothing inside of me convicts me. Whereas with my grandparents and my parents, they wanted to know everybody on the block. My mother would let us do sleepovers. Guess what? But she knew the parents. She knew people in their family. Now, my kids have never had a sleepover, and they probably won't because I don't really trust their friends' parents. And I'm being honest with you because it's the context we're in. And until the mirror is put in our face and we're honest with ourselves and realize that. And I'm just as a part of it as well because
so
it's the same.
How do we change the context? And you can answer this or anybody else can. Because what I'm hearing you say is there's a sense of fear, which is I know why the kids don't play outside because they're going to get kidnapped, which is not true. But the small stories we hear in such a big way. So fear.
I think
right?
I mean,
how do we change the context?
I think the first answer is do you even want to change it? I think that's what it really comes down to. I think fear definitely is a factor.
Well, that's why I said what is detrimental about this? You like your house? You don't want to know your neighbors? You drive in the garage? You're okay with that? So is there anything negative?
I think we have to figure out what aspects of this just are, mm-hmm. and it's just because the world changes all the time. And are we reacting to things because we can't accept the way it's changing? Or are there things that really do need to change, that need to be reversed or need to be adjusted? And so, you know, it's interesting when Derek's talking about his neighborhood. In our neighborhood, we hardly talk to our neighbors. We live there almost 16 years now, and we hardly talk to our neighbors. And we know them. They're nice people and everything. We've never talked to them. And yet in Pennsylvania, in our neighborhood, we all got together all the time for stuff. We had a poker group. We had one of the neighbors put on a big Christmas party every year, and we went to the Christmas party. In fact, the only one who knew how to sing all the Christmas carols was me. I had to teach the Christians how to sing their own carols.
So I
don't know, you know, in terms of do we want to change the way we relate to our neighbors? Is that the real problem? I don't know.
As faith leaders, this will be my last question for you, and then we'll open it up to the rest of you to speak, ask questions or comment. Is this damaging to our souls?
Great question. Well,
I think
thank you.
Yes. I think that we are spiritual beings on some level, right? So I have a desire to eat. I have to eat. I have to sleep. I have to spend time with friends. I have to have fun. I have to have something meaningful in my life, so on and so forth. But I also need something spiritual. I need to connect with the transcendent, the absolute. And if I don't, my life gets kind of out of whack, just like if I don't sleep enough or if I don't take care of my health and so on and so forth. So I do think that it can be bad because I believe, this is just my thought, I do believe a lot of this atomization is directly coming from the technology. I just think it is. But I don't think it has to be that way. But again, I think we can offer something better. I just recently discovered the whole Netflix thing. I didn't understand Netflix. The kids, they come to me, I watch Netflix for 8 hours. And I'm like, what are you watching for 8 hours? And I thought, like, movies? Like, you must really like movies. Normally, I watch a film and I'm done. You know, it's time to move on. Well, then I discovered the shows. You know about this?
Yeah.
The shows. And it's amazing. You can, like, quickly, like, waste a lot of time. It was raining my last day off, and I was like, wow, okay, I'm going to watch a lot of The Office reruns, okay? Yeah. And the show ends, and immediately it starts the next one. It's incredible. So then suddenly it dawned on me what's going on here. But I didn't really feel good later. You know, the next day, like, people are like, hey, how was your day off? I was like, oh, it was okay, you know. I wasn't like, oh, I watched, like, TV for 6 hours, right? This silly show.
20 episodes.
I didn't feel good about it, right? I mean, like, I would have rather have done something more productive and better. And I think that's part of the issue. We can complain and, oh, the technology. But the fact is, it was very easy to do that. It's the path of least resistance. To pull out my phone instead of talking to someone. It's the path of least resistance to just veg out and go into this state of unconscious. I mean, entertainment means to hold between. That's what the word root, the etymology of entertainment, is to kind of hold you in between. So you're just kind of like in this state. And we know the state is. We've been there. We all have televisions. So I do think we can offer something better. And I think that's what it is. What that is, you know, opportunities. Let's be honest, sometimes our church services, we try to imitate entertainment so much, and we can't compete with Hollywood. I know I can't. Maybe a little bit,
but I can't.
I'm pretty good, yeah. But people don't, I mean, I can't entertain people for hours on end. But we can provide something else, you know, interpersonal relations, interaction, and a contact with God. And I think that's what draws people every Sunday to our services, whether the preaching is good or not, whether the music is good or not. Because they experience something there that they can't find on television. And it's amazing that we have 500 students or whatever show up to Mass every Sunday night that could be doing anything else in the world. Why are they coming? I can tell you the bread doesn't taste good. It doesn't taste good. The wine doesn't taste good. I'd never buy that wine. You're not going to see it at Trader Joe's. And I'm not that entertaining. So there's something else there that we can offer people.
Well, when you talk about what it does to your soul, I mean, part of Christian discipleship is we're called to bear with one another. And the catch with that is I don't have to bear with someone that I like and who's like me. Mm-hmm. I only have to bear with someone who at the very least gets on my nerves or who I might find outrageous and wrong and fundamentally flawed in their thinking. That's the kind of person I have to bear with. But part of the problem that I see in our culture today, and especially when I look at our college campuses, and I'm not trying to rehash our political discussions, but this whole concept of safe spaces says, I have a right to not be offended. Well, if my highest ideal is to not be offended, guess who I'm not going to expose myself to? People who think differently than I do and who might say something that I disagree with because that offends me. I'm like, and I think that's part of the problem that we see today is we've become so, whether atomized or now we're back to just this homogeneity of, I'm only going to hang with people who think just like me, and it's this echo chamber of they're saying everything I say, and, you know, I'm fine. That's part of our problem today is that we don't have this willingness to be offended and to be okay with that and to get over it without having to respond in some inflammatory way, but to say, okay, I respectfully disagree with that. We've lost that ability to have that civil discourse and dialogue and disagree because part of this, you know, Burger King, have it your way. You know, I think back to those ads, even when I was a kid, that, you know, this customized experience of life that says, I don't have to watch anything on the screen that I don't want to watch. I don't want to have to listen to anything in the car that I don't want to have to listen to, or on the news or the TV or on my Facebook feed. I can block that person. I can unfriend them. I can create my own little insular bubble. And in doing so, I am now ill-equipped to interact in a society that is diverse.
So, first of all, Josh, completely agree with you. Spot on. Tim, I completely agree with you. Spot on. So I'm going to add on to what you guys have said. First of all, I think the damage to our soul, to put it in terms of the question you asked, Betsy, and it's a great question, is that we start to confuse pursuit of happiness with pursuit of deeper meaning and satisfaction. We get too superficial with the things that we're going after. And so then to tag on to what Tim was saying, in the context of our congregations, we can provide a context in which people can understand that we are trying to pursue something deeper. It's not just about happiness. It's about something much more. It's about connection to the transcendent. It's about connection to each other. It's about, and you can do it not just in services. It's not, I mean, I know in our congregation, it's not just about services. It's about all kinds of community events. It's about classes. It's about learning together. It's about having real discussions about things together. And yes, it's about services, and the services have to have some kind of meaningful content within it too. Not entertainment, but serious discussion or serious, insight into what the Holy Text is saying, and taking it apart and really analyzing what it's saying. And all of this helps to show that there is deeper meaning to be had that is beyond just happiness.
Okay. I'd like to have some time for you all to comment or share or ask a question. But I want to start off with this quote. Pete Seeger said, "The key to the future of the world is finding the optimistic stories and letting them be known." So you're welcome to keep hashing this out with us, or perhaps you have a story of a way that is you addressed this kind of isolation in your own life. But Christine has the mic.
Thank you. Just two comments. The first one is that I look around the room here, and I don't see any millennials here. Maybe there are some. Okay, good. To defend themselves.
They were the ones that didn't know what Bonanza was.
Okay. But my children are millennials, and I somehow disagree with some of the things that have been said. I know that when they were growing up, my wife and I had the same conversations that you guys have just been having. Why don't you go out and play? Well, they don't want to. Okay, fine. My wife pointed something out to me because I grew up in an era when you did go out and play. I was out in the street all the time. But my wife pointed out to me that in our neighborhood, most of the families work. Both the mothers and the fathers are working. So my wife was a stay-at-home mother, but she was the only one in the neighborhood. So the kids didn't go out. You know, when we were out playing, we had all the mothers in all the other houses looking over us and watching what we were doing or what we were not doing. So we had that. Now, as far as my son is in a rock band. He travels all over the world, all over the United States. But every time he comes home, I was just telling my friend here this, he just, we never see him. He's staying in our house to sleep maybe, and then to eat, but he's always out with his friends. So somehow or other, he's got himself a group of people that he hangs around with. And I suspect a lot of them do that. That was it.
You know, and if I agree with that. And you know, I'm probably Generation X, but think like a millennial. I say it that way. But I also think it's intergenerational. Here's what I mean by that. Because our current generations don't really understand the previous generations. I think there is a clear disconnection of understanding, as the old Baptist hymnal said, how I got over, what they had to endure to get there. Because a lot have grown up in this context. I keep using the word context. Grew up in this era where this is what it is. And so even at our church, I mean, I have senior members here who are very firm in their faith. They don't have their grandkids here, and they'll question everything about the text. Whereas the grandmother was raised where you don't question, you just accept. The kids are like, well, I don't understand this. And so what ends up happening is it becomes friction versus a real conversation. You know, for us, I still have friends I grew up with. We're still friends to this day. But I was in college for my 3.5 years. And guess what? I may have 3 friends in 3.5 years I'm still close with, because I wasn't going to college to meet friends. I was going to college because I was told if I get a degree, I get a good job. But I think it's important from an intergenerational standpoint that it takes both sides to try to understand the other side's world. I think that's a truth matter. I read an article in Forbes about President-elect's Trump's son-in-law and how he called his friends in Silicon Valley and asked for their help with using technology to be able to tap into a world of the electorate. And that's foreign to some people, but guess what? The best way to communicate with this generation is through IT. In fact, because that's what they have in their hands, and it's convenient in that regard. And I agree with you because, you know, the reality of it all is, again, it comes back to convenience and inconvenience, and I don't want to be put out of my comfort zone.
I have two comments. One thing that came to mind when you all were speaking is that atomization is actually good for business. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that, you know, we talked about it as if people are simply just atomized on their own. But there's a superstructure that uses media to promote atomization because it creates bigger profits for you to be in your phone or you to be in your video game or you to be in the technology that you talked about. So I think that, that needs to be acknowledged on the one hand, and I guess it leads into my second point, and that is I think the talk about the individual is kind of has been co-opted and used against us in many ways. So what I mean is you can't have a synagogue with one person. You can't have the body of Christ with one person. These are communities, but we put so much emphasis on individuals to the detriment of the community. Mm-hmm. And even in the faith tradition or against the faith traditions in some sense. So I'm wondering on how much do you all think that clergy have almost taken on a gospel or a message of individualization, atomization against faith traditions that promote community.
Yay. Yeah, I think
that was on my list of questions.
You,
excellent.
You have hit a point that is so correct, and my community at Temple Israel has heard me talk about this a number of times, and I'll talk from a Jewish perspective. Yes, being in America has been great for Jews in terms of individual liberty. There's never been a society that has given us more individual liberty, and all right, there's a rise in anti-Semitism right now, but basically with not a lot of anti-Semitism. Okay, what's been the sacrifice? The sacrifice is that the emphasis on individualism in this country has destroyed some of the basics of our religion, which is all about community. which is all about building community, which is all about understanding that our covenant with God is a communal covenant, not an individual covenant. And I always say to my congregation, Judaism is an Eastern religion that has been corrupted by Western values.
One of the questions, thank you for bringing that up, because my question was, how has the faith community contributed to isolation and divide? And one of the things I know that we Protestants have done is this whole idea of mega churches, or we have a contemporary service and a traditional service and a contemplative service, trying to meet all the different needs. And we've forgotten to sing the hymns, although I'm trying to do better at my church about that.
I think also, I agree with you. I'll be quick on it. I agree with you. I also think from a faith community standpoint is we've allowed our congregants and our parishioners, at least from the Christian perspective, and probably from you know, the word I'm used to, we've allowed ourselves to put more stock in the pastor than Jesus. And so it's more braggadocious about who my pastor is and where my church is than about the text itself. And so it becomes the bragging right. But I also agree on the business front, because you're absolutely correct. Yeah. You're absolutely correct in that regard. We can't overlook that.
Yeah. And by the way, one of the ways that Judaism has changed in America is that before we lived in America, rabbis were not pastors. Rabbis didn't act as ministers. Rabbis were teachers, were leaders of the community. That's what the traditional role is. And now we've become people who have to do life cycles and, you know, and pastoring and so forth, because that's what America expects.
Yeah, Jim Cranston, First Baptist Church. I think the faith community is the answer to all of this. A brief statement. The goal of the Torah is that human beings will become more alike. The Torah is meant to make us all converge toward a certain image of the perfect human being. In this sense, it is inimical to individuality. In a society that had fully realized the Torah's goals, all its members would become similar in respect to our spiritual and intellectual nature, the most essential part of us. If all would reach intellectual perfection, human heterogeneity would disappear. Maimonides, the guide of the text.
I recognize that, Jim.
Right back at the back.
Have a millennial.
Turn it on. It's off.
Is that young man wearing a Gator shirt?
Go Gators!
You got a lot of guts, son.
So this is actually something that's like really hit home for me, namely as someone who grew up an atheist and converted later in life. I get it's easy to kind of beat on millennials, but something that really made me into an atheist is I looked at churches, I looked at Christians in particular, and saw these atomized people who are no different than society. When I looked at churches, they acted a lot like businesses. When I looked at Christians, they had a focus more on individualism in terms of economic success, in terms of their own self-interest and stuff like that, and it wasn't in any way divine. You know, I looked at a community that to me just looked like another secular institution, just with a different name. And I found that when I came to a church community that really drove home spirituality, spiritual disciplines, real transformation, community-centered, I really appreciated what you said about the covenant is about a communal covenant, not this individual one. When I went to a church that stressed that, suddenly religion became something powerful. And it connected. I've seen millennials just like myself say the same thing. It's not that they're fleeing to secular society. They just don't see a difference anymore. And I think part of that is that this atomization leads to a compartmental thinking in our lives, where we can go to church on Sunday, and Sunday's a section that we put off religion, and then the rest of our lives we don't have to become more just. We don't have to become more Christ-like in these other parts of the areas. So I guess what I'm asking is, where do you think the church can go from there, at least with that? Because I do think the church still has a lot to offer. I think people want, they crave this divine relationship, they crave this higher thinking, this full life transformation, and they want something that's different than what society has to offer. So what do you guys think? What's next? How can the church help?
Your testimony, the first thing it drew to my mind was Jesus' words that John records, which is, they'll know you're my disciples by the love that you have for each other. And so what you weren't seeing before that was that mutual sharing of love that followers of Christ are called to demonstrate. That's when he said, here's how they're going to tell, It wasn't all these other things. He said, this epitomizes being my follower, is the love that you have for each other. So even you sharing that, I think, is a reminder that that's what we're called to do within the church faith community.
What's your name again? Michael. Well, you know, number one, thank you. I don't think you need to ask a question. I think your statement is correct and convicting. You know, another thing I would add to that, I think the reason why you saw it finally is because you're going to a place, you're exposed to a place where it's true essence of the scriptures and not of the individual declaring the scripture. When I aforementioned, I really believe that is the scripture says that in the last days they will resist sound doctrine. I think it becomes that point now where I want to feel good. I want to be told all these great things about myself, that if I give this, God will give me this back. And the truth of the matter, that's just not reality. And I mean, add on to that, from a pastoral standpoint, my struggle is I desire what you desire, yet pastors some people who want the individualism. And when they don't get it, they leave. Because they've either come from somewhere or want to go somewhere where they're going to be told, you're going to get everything you want from God. But the fact of the matter is, if you're actually honest with the scriptures and you look at it from Jesus' life, everything he did was for a community, not for a person. Even the belief that we have in the cross itself, it was for people. It wasn't for himself. And so everything you said, I appreciate you, not even because you're a millennial. I just think it's factual. And it's a real struggle and it's a burden. And from a pastor standpoint, I'll tell you that it's very hard because, you know, like today, I mean, be very frank. I'm hosting this event. I have four parishioners of my church here. No, imagine how that makes me feel. It really does, because the fact that I'm, because there's, I don't see how this benefits me is the opinion. And so what you said is factual, and it is disheartening, it's frustrating, but it's also, you know, people read the scriptures to find verses that make them feel good about themselves, not about how it's going to help Betsy out.
I just want to note that Michael's sitting between his pastors, so shout out to pastors that are getting it right.
Yeah, I'd like to say one, do we have a minute? Do we still have some time? Yeah. To comment on what you're saying, I agree with you too, also 100%. Sadly, I've seen in my own churches, occasionally priests, I think it can be very seductive, and maybe, I'm not a pastor right now, so I can say this very easily, but it can be very seductive to, oh, I'm in charge of all these things, and so on. And I go to meetings sometimes in different places, and I've served, and I wonder, why are we talking about this, you know? The answer to our world's problem is not hanging more TVs on the wall, right? I mean, you're not going to walk into a church and be impressed because there's TVs everywhere. You got those at home. You got them in your pocket, right? And we talked about this at lunch, about it's one thing to go out in the community and say, hey, come on out to our church, but are you going to really be there in the end? Are you going to really be with them and serve them and so on? So are we, and I'm so glad you shared that insight, because I think we're not always, we are, there are priests out there, I've heard them talk about parishioners as clients, customers. We're providing a service for them, and they return by hopefully giving us money in the collection basket so we can feather our nest and have more fish fries and things of that nature. But that's not what the mission of the gospel is as a Catholic Christian. I don't think it's the mission of these, my colleagues up here either. And I don't think that's what our society is yearning and longing for. It's just another club like the Elks or the Moose Lodge or whatever else there is, right? They're looking for something different that's going to speak to their desires of their heart. And it sounds like that's what you found, ultimately.
Betsy, do we have time for one more?
We sure do.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what you guys think on creating these individualized worlds where we're never offended and how that probably cuts against the most offensive thing of all, which would be Christianity. And for 24 years, I was not a Christian, and it was very offensive to hear all the things that Jesus says. And if we are, as a society, creating these isolated bubbles that never offends us, because I only read everything I agree with, and I don't even go to church unless I think my pastor's amusing or whatever, and not hear, I guess, truth. Because spiritually, which was your question, I think the devil's going to tell us everything we love, right? And truth, a lot of times, is not seductive. So I guess just what are your thoughts on the spiritual ramifications of that?
Oh, Okay.
We have to be challenged. Can I just say that? Yeah. We have to be challenged. I mean, no one ever, you get people complaining about, this guy's a Jesus freak, or he's taking this religion too seriously. But I've met so many people who every day wear nothing but FSU Seminoles clothes, who spend all their time researching like what we're recruiting, and no one ever cares about that. I've seen funerals where people want to dress, you know, with a casket up in Alabama stuff and play the fight song. I think that's crazy, right? That's insane. I mean,
you're an Auburn fan, it is.
Exactly. I'm sure. But that's the thing. It's simple. You can live like that, and that doesn't challenge me. It doesn't challenge me. But if I'm a Christian or a Jewish man, I assume anybody. I mean, I'm making a statement. I'm making a stand. I'm saying this is what I believe is the truth, and I believe this is the way that one should live. And I could even be a tolerant person and say, hey, you know, you're doing your thing. But it's still going to bring a challenge. When I say Jesus Christ rose from the dead, that puts a challenge. You have to either believe it or not. And that creates a friction. And I don't think that's something we need to run from, right? Whether it's in that religious scope, or we can talk about it, we can respect one another. But it does, you're right. If we are constantly insulating ourselves, the gospel can't get out, absolutely not. And I don't think any of our faiths can.
It's 2 minutes. Do you think we have one more, Christine? Okay, go ahead, Eric.
Only thing that comes to mind with what you said is I'll tell my folks a lot, the gospel, when properly presented, is inherently offensive. Don't add any needless offense to it. So I think that's a reminder that, like, if properly presented, it's going to offend because what it says about who you are and how you're living. But we sure don't need to be adding offense to it by bringing in other garbage that's unrelated or would undermine it.
Okay, that'll be the last question.
Yeah, this is very quick, and it's actually kind of a retreat back to sort of some of the original conversation. My son likes to play soccer, and so I was trying to, you know, help him learn to play. And as we would drive around, as opposed to like when I was a kid, we found like all the school fields now are locked up. Like it was so weird because as a kid, that's where we would go play. We would go to the high school, we'd go to the junior high, and we would drive around, and there's no place to play. But then here's the deal. Like, we went to Tom Brown, and they have some soccer fields there. And we went there, and if you've ever been to Tom Brown on a Sunday afternoon, I like to say it's like the United Nations, especially if you're a soccer fan. You see people there with jerseys on from Latin America and from Africa and from Japan. And I looked at him, and I said, well, if you want to go play, you're going to have to go play with those guys. And there were three or four different languages being spoken. And he was in the minority, but as a father, I had to, like, well, he wants to play, and plus, like, we are going to have to kind of be intentional about being uncomfortable, about being in places that are not easy, but go.
Yeah.
Be there. So
I'm gonna close it by saying that all these things that we have talked about that contribute to isolation also put us to sleep, right? That we're anesthetized, and it takes energy to wake up. So I'm closing with a quote of the very old Heraclitus. Is that how you say it?
Heraclitus.
Depends on what school you went to. and he says this, "Awake, we share the world. Sleeping, each turns to his private world." So I would say thanks for coming. I hope we're all a little bit more awake than when we walked in.
Well done.
Good job.
Good job. Seriously.
I'm glad you
Heraclitus. Heraclitus.
I'm glad you moderated, because that was...
Okay.
That's where we get Cletus from.
The
if you ever grew up with a Cletus...